You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hello, folks. Welcome. Welcome to this Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee briefing on the state of digital copyrights on the Internet. What we wanted to do today was to do a quick briefing on what's going on with copyrights. We planned this thing months and months and months ago on the topic, and we had no idea that the Copyright Office was going to come out yesterday with jailbreaking rulings and also DVD clipping for professors. So the idea today is that we wanted to get the general congressional briefing snapshot on where digital copyrights are on the Internet with regard to digital downloads, enforcement issues, things related to how ISPs and content owners are working together or not to police infringing activities on the Internet, international agreements that are being made, things like that. What we did was we put together a panel of experts who'll do a quick briefing on some cases that should be of interest to members of Congress and their staff, the enforcement issues that are going on with the government and international bodies, and then also a look at some trade agreements and the work of the White House with regard to enforcement coordination among the various entities. So before we get into the panel that includes Jonathan Band, Matt Shears, Tom Steidnor, and Mark Bohannon, what I'd like to do is have an expert from the Department of Commerce, Mark Baraka, who last time I did a briefing was actually about 10 years ago on privacy for us. And Mark did an excellent panel at the Department of Commerce several weeks ago called, it was a symposium on copyright policy, creativity, and innovation in the internet economy. And he did a panel on emerging services and business models for legitimate distribution of copyrighted works. We wanted Mark to come and just give a brief summary because we couldn't put together a panel about all the different things that are happening with regard to how well people are actually distributing copyrighted works online in legitimate ways, in the ways that people are purchasing them. We could have spent like an entire month on that on this panel, but we asked Mark to come and summarize it in like 10 minutes, if he can, to give us an overview of what's happening legitimately with regard to digital downloads on the Internet. So let me introduce Mark Baraka. He is Senior Advisor to Secretary Locke at the Department of Commerce, an old and good friend, not old, but a young, but long friend of the Congressional Internet Caucus. Mark?
Thanks, Tim. First off, I think we have to admit we're old, and some of you in the room have been around.
Speak for yourself, Mark.
You might be older than me, Mark. But many of us have been working these issues for a long time, and so before I get into exactly what Tim asked me to do, let me try to provide for those of you in the audience a little bit of context. And it's fascinating to me. I've worked on tech policy issues now for over a decade, as Tim said. And in my immediate past life, I did so as a member of the private sector. And so I got to move between the Hill and the administration, trade association meetings and the like. And I felt like I had a good grasp on sort of the breadth of activity in D.C. When I'm at the Commerce Department, I realize that although the Capitol and the Commerce Department are less than a mile apart, sometimes the information flow makes it seem like we're thousands of miles apart. So if, with your indulgence, I'll take a couple minutes first to talk to you about what the Commerce Department is doing to, I'll say, revitalize its role in helping to shape Internet policy more broadly. So stepping back in that direction, and, you know, sort of providing you a high-level picture, we at the Commerce Department are now running, I'd say, at full speed what we refer to as an Internet Policy Task Force. When the Obama administration came into office and started populating the White House, populating the Commerce Department and other agencies, it did so, I think, following through on the promise of the campaign, and that was to bring in to policymaking positions some fairly tech-savvy people. And in our mind, that creates great opportunity. It creates an opportunity to take a fresh look at some pressing tech policy issues, not just copyright online, but other tech policy issues, and ask ourselves, what should be the framework for the next decade? If we think historically, you can say that during the 1990s, the internet indeed was nascent, or the commercial internet was indeed nascent. And the Commerce Department back then and the other folks in the Clinton administration adopted a do-no-harm posture and took a lot of individual steps to make the commercial internet a reality. So Al Gore doesn't get credit for inventing the internet, but I do think the Clinton administration gets credit for enabling, taking policy steps that enabled the commercial internet to grow. If you look at the last decade, I think it's fair to say that there was a preoccupation with post 9/11 issues, legitimately and appropriately, but also efforts in the policy front to address pinpoint issues. Anti-spam legislation, identity theft legislation. You know, there were certain issues that arose on the internet that really plagued consumers and plagued the environment, and they were tackled sort of on an individual basis. As we look forward into the next decade, we at the Commerce Department and elsewhere in the administration are given our experiences and I think our sense of having some knowledge of how the policy environment has evolved and how technology evolves so quickly, we feel like we have an opportunity to address some of the most pressing, bigger issues that have become pressing because they've been out there for quite some time. And so that's really the purpose of our Internet Policy Task Force, is to look at those big challenges and ask ourselves, are there any new policy levers we can identify and that we can pull? Our work is proceeding in four streams. One, we're looking at online data protection or privacy. And another news item from yesterday is that Senator Kerry indicated he intends to introduce privacy legislation. This privacy legislation simmering over on the House side. And so I think it's not a coincidence that we at the Commerce Department, on behalf of the administration, are looking at legislation or other policies that can guide data collection and data management practices. We're also looking at cybersecurity. Tim mentioned that a few weeks ago we had a symposium on copyright issues. Yesterday we had a symposium on cybersecurity. Same question. Are there policy levers that can be pulled that can improve the level of cybersecurity in the commercial space? And let me pause here because I want to offer up a philosophical point. That's relevant not just to cybersecurity but to all our work streams, including copyright. When I say identify policy levers, we have a very broad notion of what that means. Many of us here think of policy as something that gets legislated or regulated because that's what we do for a living. We either legislate or regulate. You know, at the Commerce Department, we have the luxury of not regulating much of anything at all. And so we recognize that legislation and regulation can play a role. But importantly, in the policy space, there are things that government can do to convene, to pull stakeholders together, to ask them what they might be able to do collectively. We can look at the standard-setting process and ask whether private sector standards are evolving rapidly enough to address pressing public needs. Or if the standard setting process isn't moving fast enough, you know, is there some government hand-holding or government coaxing that can accelerate standard setting? So when I think of the policy toolkit, it's a much more robust toolkit, much more it's like the toolkit in your garage. There are many tools in the toolkit, not just legislation or regulation, and that's what we're looking at when we examine these issue areas at the Commerce Department. So we have privacy, we have cybersecurity. A third area, which we'll be more public about post-Labor Day, is the free flow of information on the Internet. The State Department has done a great job, I think, highlighting the importance of free speech and democratization around the world and the role that the Internet can play in that space. At the Commerce Department, we look at some of our keystone companies on the Internet. And we say, you know, they ought to be successful globally. They are today. Are there impediments to their success that other countries are throwing up that are putting in place that will make it difficult for us to be the purveyors of information and information services globally? So that's a third work stream, more about that post Labor Day. And then our fourth work stream is in the area that we're all talking about today, and that's in protecting intellectual property online. From a Commerce Department perspective, we know very, very well that copyright infringement online continues to be a significant problem. Here, too, U.S. companies are global leaders. One of our global competitive advantages, far and away, is our ability to invent information technology, our ability to invent information services. But also one of our global competitive advantages is our ability to generate entertainment, knowledge, and other things that our creators make, not just our inventors. And so when we see rampant piracy online, revenue losses, and understand that those revenue losses translate into lost jobs or lost opportunities to create jobs, that plagues us. You know, in the current environment, it's all about jobs, 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 jobs. You can't say that often enough. Jobs, 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 jobs. And so we know that there's a connection between losses online to our creators and job preservation and job growth. So the policy question is, what do we do about that? You know, at the same time, you know, there's no hiding the fact that there is, at least in the public policy debate, there are strong divisions between U.S. companies, between our creators of content and some of our information services companies. And so, you know, we're at the Commerce Department reluctant to get into that egg-throwing contest. It can be pretty heated. You know, if you're a staffer on these issues, you probably get whiplash from time to time hearing the arguments of, quote-unquote, one side, and then going into a meeting, you know, within the same day and hearing arguments, quote-unquote, from the other side. Because the sides are very passionate in their views and sometimes appear to be statements that are diametrically opposed. At the Commerce Department, we are trying to discern whether there are win-win outcomes here. We would like to have it both ways, frankly. We would like to see continuing success of our information technology sector, and we would like to aggressively combat online copyright infringements. So how do we do that? Well, again, we are in exploration mode, and as Tim mentioned, the other day we had a symposium on online copyright issues, and one of the most successful panels, I think, was the one that highlighted how there is some movement towards the middle on these issues. On the panel, we had Sony Music, we had a representative of book publishers, we had a representative of photographers, we had YouTube. You know, so starting with the bookends, the representative. I'm sorry. Jonathan representing the librarians. Forgive me.
Potted
plant. I figured. You can speak your own piece. So we had VP for basically new markets for Sony Music, and he described how Sony Music, you know, which is different from Apple. We all know that Apple has been extremely successful in creating a business model that works for itself and funnels revenues to artists and to labels. Sony Music continues to work this problem, and they're coming up with a range of different licensing models that they feel can inch them closer and closer to successful online businesses. This requires close collaboration with internet service providers. So to be more concrete, the most I think compelling story coming from Sony Music is that they're looking to establish a music bundle. Much as today you can turn on your cable set-top box and find up at channel 800 or channel 400 or wherever, you know, a range of music channels. They're working on licensing deals with internet service providers, folks who provide you internet access, so that you can, quote-unquote, pipe music into your home over the internet. So that's one example of progress towards what I'd call the middle. At the other end of the of the stage, we had YouTube, which is working on a technology called Content ID. And this is a tool that will enable YouTube to more quickly identify uploaded movies that are actually pirated versions of legitimate movies. And so, you know, there's lots of engagement between YouTube/Google and the content community, as we all know. One of the positive developments is this technological tool that will make it easier for content companies to approach Google and YouTube and have them take down infringing works. I'm not being Pollyannish about the path towards the middle. There are still problems. The book publishers talked about how they're concerned that there isn't sufficient standardization in the e-books space. And so, you know, when you're a book publisher, you don't make much money, frankly. When you're an author, you don't make much money, frankly. And if you could format your book just one time for the e-medium, that would be really, really helpful to them, because it would reduce their costs. It would make it easy for them to just, you know, format once and move forward. It's a touchy area. You know, Amazon has been very successful with the Kindle. You know, when the government considers requests from the private sector to move standards along quickly, we have to be very careful not to stifle innovation. But in any event, I throw that out as an example of a challenge area. The photographers also indicated that they have no existing tool for keeping track of when people copy a picture from a website and put it into their personal files. So there are hurdles to overcome, but I think we were successful in identifying that technology can be part of the solution, for sure. And then we ask ourselves, if technology can be part of the solution, you know, what's left for policy? And I will stop there because I've consumed a lot of time, but just say that we have a notice of inquiry coming out shortly where we will be publicly asking people these questions. What is the future role of technology? What are the future business models that sort of sidestep some of these, you know, policy debates? What more can be done to educate users about the importance of protecting intellectual property online? And so we continue to be in fact-finding mode on this topic. We hope to have a report actually out before the end of the calendar year that will inform the White House position and also hopefully your positions here. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. I'm actually glad I didn't get into a long, you know, orientation, you know, introduction, because you actually did a really good job of summarizing some of the issues, particularly the pressure with regard to jobs and content creation and protecting copyrighted works. And you also went through a good list of it's not just legislate, regulate, but also – or litigate, but it's also cooperate. So there's a lot of things going on in innovation and things like that. So I think that was a really good overview of copyright – the state of copyright policy. And so with that – I wanted to just go to each one of the panelists. We have Jonathan Band, who also participated in Mark's panel on copyright. Jonathan is a lawyer here in Washington and does a lot of work with different companies, including the American Library Association and the librarians on different issues. He's with Policy Bandwidth. Then we have Tom Seidnor from the Progress and Freedom Foundation, who is does a lot of work in this area as well. We have Matt Scherz from the Computer and Communications Industry Association, and then down at the very end is Mark O'Hannon from the Software and Information Industry Association. So if I could just very quickly, because we have a lot of material to get to, I want to ask the panelists what their view is the basic state of copyright on the Internet is right now. Then we'll go into a brief discussion of some of the cases that have happened in recent memory that kind of show us how this thing is happening with regard to litigation. Then we'll go into some of the enforcement issues, including the trade agreement and what the White House is doing. So if I can just ask you guys really quickly to say, you know, what your perspective are, who you represent, and how you feel like the state of copyright on the Internet is right now. We'll just go down from right to left, my right to left. Jonathan?
Thank you very much, Tim. So this obviously is a very complicated area. We could spend all day talking about it, but we won't. Ever since Al Gore didn't invent the Internet, as Mark told us, we've been having conversations about this issue, about digital copyrights and copyrights on the Internet. And every Congress, there's a certain pattern that evolves, so that The entertainment industry, the content industry comes to Congress, says the sky is falling, we need help, we need legislation. Congress responds, they pass legislation. Then the next Congress comes, even though the industry is still there, the industry says we need help, we're getting hammered, Congress responds. And that has gone on literally for every single Congress since the mid-90s. And so, and yet these industries still survive and thrive. The ticket sales for the motion picture industry are higher than ever. Software industry revenues continue to be very high. The music industry as a whole is doing well. The record industry segment is doing poorly, but the industry as a whole is doing well. So you sort of say, well, what's going on here? And so it suggests there's a couple of things. Either the problem is not as serious as the industry suggests it is, not to say that there isn't a problem, but it's perhaps not as dire as it repeatedly claims, or that maybe this is a problem that doesn't really, there really isn't a legislative solution to the problem, that there's, as Mark indicated, maybe is more a matter of technology and business models than legislation. And I think that that's something that really we need to think about very carefully and seriously. I mean, given that literally in every Congress there has been legislation just in the last Congress. We passed the Pro-IP Act, you know, this massive bill that was supposed to improve enforcement of intellectual property. So I think it is a fair question, you know, have we reached the limits of what legislation can do at this point in time? And I'll just close my opening remarks with noting that Congress in 1998 passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which established, which in many ways was the outcome of the Clinton administration's review of this area. And the DMCA established a framework for sort of shared responsibility between the technology companies, the service providers, and the copyright industries, and it had a system of notice and takedown with respect to hosting sites and search engines, and it looks like, at least from my point of view, that basic framework established by Congress in 1998 has been an incredible success. You didn't have YouTube then, but you have YouTube now. And if you talk about digital copyrights, you need to say not only the copyrights or not only the creativity of Hollywood, but you've got to look at all of the user-generated content and the enormous creativity. I mean, that the Copyright Act is not written for the entertainment industry, and the intellectual property clause in the Constitution nowhere says it's about guaranteeing Hollywood's profits, right? I mean, it talks about progress of science and the useful arts. And you look at YouTube and you look at the explosion of creativity on the Internet, and you've got to say, well, maybe things are working pretty well. So that's my view, is that the DMCA is a tremendous success story, and, you know, we shouldn't be tinkering with it.
Okay, I actually, in my opening comments, I didn't summarize what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is, but we'll move through that during our comments. We'll make sure we kind of, as Jonathan did, kind of explain a little bit more about the DMCA. So that's an important part of this conversation today. Tom, let me go to you. I shuffled that around the chairs. I apologize for that, but let's see.
Certainly. By Tom Sidner of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. It's a 501c3 nonpartisan think tank focused on the implications of digital technology for society and public policy. Where are we with copyrights on the Internet? Well, step back and just say one thing, and that's that I think it is important to acknowledge that we do have a huge infringement problem on the Internet right now. We are seeing levels of infringement that have typically been seen only in the past, only in the developing world. And the long-term consequences of infringement levels that sustain are easily assessed by looking at some of the countries that have had very high levels of piracy for very long times and have simply decimated their own internal, their own creative industries. They simply barely exist anymore. I think there is a serious problem. How are we doing on solving it? Actually, the current state of affairs is fairly promising. The truth of the matter is, process has not gone smoothly, but no process of innovation ever does. And that's what we're trying to do here. For about the first 200 years of our history, we enforced copyrights by making intermediaries strictly liable for any mistakes they made in the handling of other people's work. That system worked really well. It was absolutely, it made copyrights essentially transparent to consumers. They just didn't even have to think about them. And it made it easy to enforce. Unfortunately, that system creates kind of a whitelist type of world. You have to be very careful about clearing rights. It's not the sort of system that would allow something like a photo sharing site like Flickr to exist. So with the DMCA, we began a process to try to figure out, can we give the intermediaries a little bit more flexibility than they've had in the past, but without making copyrights unenforceable or shoving enforcement all the way over onto consumers, which is not something we would want to do as a policy perspective. And, you know, that process has proceeded in fits and starts. The courts and Congress have been very heavily involved in it. But today, I think if you look where we are, actually we're at a pretty good point. One of the things that the DMCA did back in 1998 is there's a provision in Ulrigat called relating to standard technical measures that actually basically presumes that over the long run, the best answers are likely to come from cooperation between all the various sectors in the internet commerce infrastructure. And recently what we have seen this is to the administration's great credit, I might add, Mark, from both bipartisan members of both parties in Congress and the administration, very consistent calls for everyone involved in internet commerce, from the rights holders to the access providers, online service providers, payment processors, to work together to try to figure out what are the answers enforcing individual civil rights, which are what copyrights are, online. And, I think the move to push people towards addressing those questions, very important. And I think we've come to the point where everybody realizes, you know, there's not going to be one magic bullet. We're going to have a series of challenges that will evolve over time, and we'll need to keep rethinking, keep thinking about what we're doing. But what I see today that I don't think we've seen as much in the past is recognition that, yeah, there really is a problem. It's really quite serious. We really need to think about how to solve it. And you see the same thing going on, I'm also comforted to say, other countries around the world. You see it at colleges and universities. There's a lot of careful thought going on these days. That's actually very, very promising.
Thanks, Tom. Matt?
My name is Matt Shears. I'm with the Computer and Communications Industry Association. It's the trade association of internet and technology companies. So sort of looking at the landscape, I'd say there's sort of two sets of issues. One, which are issues that are primarily being litigated right now, is debates about how to allocate the cost between relevant stakeholders in online enforcement where, you know, everybody's at the table. And then there's another set of issues that's about enforcement where you've got parties which are basically pirates who are not at the table and not interested in participating in this in the enforcement of IP rights. And those don't necessarily need to be copyrights. There's certainly a lot of other IP issues, and counterfeiting online, sale of counterfeited goods, for example, is another issue that certainly affects the public, and insofar as consumers don't have, you know, white shoe law firms to protect their rights vis-a-vis being sold counterfeited goods, that's probably a more important priority than rights holders, copyright holders who generally do and frequently use, have access to pretty effective legal teams. So, well, there's sort of that enforcement pile of issues, and then this sort of distribution of costs. And what I mean by the distribution of costs is we're seeing a lot of litigation between enterprises like Viacom and YouTube, or UMG and Vio, where relevant and generally responsible parties are fighting over who needs to bear a fixed amount of costs in handling online copyright infringement. Not surprisingly, both parties want to minimize their costs. Congress basically said who bears those costs in 1998 in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. and that established, among many other things, a safe harbor that says if ISPs or online service providers or however you want to broadly define that group implement certain kind of policies and agree to do certain things and respond to copyright complaints, then we're going to hold them harmless or we're going to limit any monetary remedies against them for acts done by their users. And that seemed like a pretty good compromise at the time, and it seems like a pretty good compromise today. The problem is that that requires a certain amount of proactive activity on behalf of rights holders. And that's not surprising because only rights holders know what they own. Unlike with patents where I can go to the PTO and actually see written down on paper everything, every right that the government has ever granted to anybody, I can't do that with respect to copyrights. There is no record. We do have a copyright registry system, although it has been subject to some criticism, and it is not comprehensive because any time anything is fixed in any tangible medium, and that includes the emails you got today, and that includes the invitation that the advisory caucus sent you today, that was all copyrighted, and the government never granted any sort of paper that says that they have this right. So there's no way to know who owns what except for rights holders. And so the system says, okay, well, you guys, you rights holders, have to complain, and that sort of starts the ball rolling. So that cost is a something that rights holders would like to minimize, and so we see a lot of litigation where there's efforts to push those costs onto ISPs. And by and large, the Viacom case is a good example, that hasn't been particularly successful, and I think that's a good thing, and it will be good for Internet policy generally if those results are borne out. Obviously, those cases will keep going. And then on the sort of enforcement side, we tend not to see that, this not shaking out in litigation. We tend to see it in other areas. So the interesting things that are happening in that area is the IP enforcement coordinator recently released the joint strategic plan, and that indicates there's going to be this 120-day review period where they're going to look at options for IP enforcement legislation, which will deal with all sorts of issues, among which I would say digital copyright is probably one of the lesser significant issues. It's going to also deal with things like counterfeits and counterfeit pharmaceuticals and counterfeit semiconductors, and those have serious health and safety implications. And then yet another issue on the sort of enforcement side is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which I think Tim alluded to.
We'll try to get to it.
And that's also relevant, but obviously I won't try and summarize it here.
Okay. Well, let me finish up with Mark on what the state of the copyrights are on the Internet, and then we'll kind of go – I'm going to ask Mark, since I have I'm going to take advantage of him, to kind of give a summary of kind of the key points of the DMCA. And Mark?
This hour in the morning, I'll do my best on your last question. I'm Mark Bohannon. I'm general counsel of the Software and Information Industry Association. We are the largest and principal association of the software and business information industry. I think the state of copyrights on the Internet are, in a sense, it's hard for me to disagree with any of my colleagues, but let me leave you with a couple of major points. As Mark Bureka indicated, you know, the reality is that the online delivery of software is a reality. I think we will see a day very soon when the notion of getting software on a disk has disappeared completely. It's about there already. The Internet is the medium of delivery and use of software, not only U.S., but increasingly globally. The second issue, and I think this is important to understand for our industry, is that the economics of the software industry, yes, we have major brands, which many of you recognize and would recognize in this room, but the reality of the software industry is, in fact, that it is dominated by small and medium-sized software publishers. The typical software company has three products, one of which accounts for 60 to 65% of its revenue. If it has the inability to protect that one product, it is not going to be able to continue to innovate and do research and development that basically provide applications and tools for businesses and consumers around the world. So that when we think about this issue, it's important to realize that this is not just about large companies trying to protect their assets, which is a very vital issue when it comes to protecting jobs, having our economy grow, maintaining our pace of innovation, particularly in the face of tremendous global competition right now. It is about also preserving where the new jobs are coming from with small and medium-sized enterprises. The third point I would make is, and Tom alluded to this, though I'm not quite as sanguine as he is that when we talk about copyrights on the Internet, we're talking about a global issue. When the Internet, the beauty of the Internet is that our members and the U.S. software and business information industry can reach customers around the world in the click of a mouse. That makes the management of intellectual assets incredibly difficult. The numbers, yes, the software industry as a whole is doing generally well, though depending on who you are, the margins are not as great as they were 10 years ago. But increasingly, if you look at where revenues are coming from, yes, our economy is the largest and remains the largest in the world, but even our small and medium-sized companies are increasingly having revenues and sales from outside North America. This makes the ability to do business on the Internet with confidence an absolutely essential element of our policy and our legal framework. And the challenge is that, yes, while I think there is growing recognition globally for how to have effective enforcement and recognition of those rights on the Internet, it is far from a given that we can do that with confidence. In my capacity, I serve on the executive committee of the U.S. Information Technology Office in Beijing. I don't have to tell everyone in this room the challenges we have there. But we are talking about a very patchwork approach globally when it comes to the effective recognition and enforcement of rights globally. And I think that as we look at these issues, how do we, consistent with our own legal principles and values and policies, make sure that we have a partner in the U.S. government that works effectively with their counterparts to make sure that we are maintaining those rights? And that leads me to my fourth point, and then I'll try to, get to Tim's question. For our industry, the issue of anti-piracy is increasingly one where we are unfortunately seeing in far too many cases. We go after those who are selling illegal content and illegal software on the Internet, who are increasingly engaged in what I would call at best other nefarious activities. This is not a, I think, simple situation where, you know, an individual is just copying a few copies here. Our anti-piracy effort is really focused on the truly bad actors. And let me give you a couple of anecdotes, which I think give a flavor of this. We spent many years pursuing a young man named Jeremiah Mondello, who was using fraudulent IDs and processes and was producing the highest quality replications of well-known software, the art of which even the experts in a company could not discern as different from their own. We determined that, and the investigation that followed, is that this individual was not only engaging in tremendous, literally optical disc counterfeit activity, he was engaging in identity theft that law enforcement believe resulted in millions of dollars. This was one individual working out of his bedroom who was basically using unencrypted wireless networks in his neighborhood and getting fraudulent IDs. Is this an anecdote? Yeah, it's an anecdote. But we're finding this kind of thing far too increasingly common as we are looking at how to make sure that what consumers buy on Internet marketplaces is what they expect, that it works, that it makes sure that it does not have security flaws, and that we are seeing, and we're pleased that the IP strategy recognizes this, that this is an integral problem of making sure that consumers are protected, not just in making sure they get the software or the business information that they want, but also in terms of the quality of the product. I think in terms of the DMCA, and I'll leave with I'll open it with this way, which is I think Mr. Bannon and I are in agreement at least in one area, that the DMCA is a viable part of our policy. I think that it has proven itself to be an effective tool. But I think there's a lot more that we can do to make it work better. And one area that we are quite concerned about, which I think does require rights holders, the ISPs, and others working together, is that if at the heart of the DMCA are notice and takedown requirements, they've got to work. That when something goes down, it needs to stay down. And we're finding in far too many cases, we go after online site that is doing nothing but pirating illegal software. We get that taken down, and then it shows up in another place because they've taken the exact same name to another service provider. It is a constant whack-a-mole. We've got to work together. If the DMCA is going to work right, we've got to work together to make sure that there are effective means that if something is taken down, it stays down. That is not only the interest of the rights holders. It's in the interest of consumers who are being misled about where they might be getting effective software, quality information, and that we've got to make sure that we have, in fact, practices and policies that make the DMCA work right, because it is at the core of our legal system, our principles, and we've really got to focus on that. So, with Tim, I turn that over to you. Back to you.
Right. And with regard to as we go through the DMCA, if there's a phrase or a term like notice and takedown, if you could just spend a second describing what that is, so we all, particularly me, so we understand that. At this point, let me just go quickly to a round of questions on just recent cases, to the extent that Congress should be aware of them, dealing with how the DMCA is working, how copyright on the internet is being enforced or not. And in the few cases that were brought up to me that people thought would be interesting to discuss is obviously, and Matt already mentioned one, Google versus YouTube. There's another one, LimeWire. And then there's another one, which is a kind of a damages case, the Tenenbaum case. If we could just all the panelists kind of just give their views on what these cases reflect, whether the DMCA is working in the sense that it's not ambiguous or not anachronistic, and how does it reflect the tension between, as Matt was saying, ISPs who are at the table and maybe ISPs who are not at the table and rights holders. So if I could just anybody can jump in. Maybe I can go to Jonathan first, and jump in and whenever you like.
Sure. So those three cases that you mentioned, Tim, I think indicate that courts get it, because I think all three decisions were right. Now, if you had mentioned other decisions, maybe I'd say the courts were getting it wrong. But when you mentioned those three decisions, I think the courts are getting it right. So with respect to the Viacom YouTube litigation, it was a very much an issue of statutory construction about the DMCA and with this notice and takedown arrangement that others have talked about, where you had Viacom sent 100,000 takedown notices, YouTube took the content down, but Viacom's position in essence was that YouTube was not eligible for the DMCA safe harbor because it had the fact that there was so much infringing content on the site indicated a general awareness of infringement, which meant that they should lose their safe harbor.
Well, Jonathan, let me just ask you, what is the safe harbor? What does that do for
you? Well, the safe harbor, as others have indicated, is it basically says is that if the way it's structured is if a service provider responds to the takedown notice in an expeditious manner, then it is not liable for monetary damages. So in this case, notwithstanding the fact that YouTube took down the allegedly infringing content, Viacom still said that they are eligible for damages. And actually, if you do the math, over $1 billion of damages by virtue of the fact that they shouldn't get this safe harbor. And so the court, sort of looking at the statutory intent, the legislative history, and so forth, concluded no, that the DMCA, you do not lose your DMCA safe harbor simply by virtue of this generalized knowledge. If you have to have awareness of specific infringement, and if you're responding expeditiously to those notices, then that general awareness doesn't make you ineligible.
Well, let me stay on Google and YouTube for a second. And Mark was intimating at the end of, or actually being explicit at the end of his comments, was that maybe this whack-a-mole notice and takedown process just isn't working. Tom, Mark, Bohannon, do you kind of agree with Jonathan that the court got it right and Google?
No. I would estimate the result that the odds of the court's reasoning being upheld on appeal at zero. It is a ridiculously badly reasoned decision. It's quite cursory. And I'm just very disappointing that we got it. The district, when the case goes up on appeal, the Second Circuit will essentially have to start the analysis over and this time try to do it credibly. What the judge in the Viacom YouTube case has done is essentially put us in the position of relitigating the Grokster case. Grokster was a case from 2005 in which some lower courts had developed the impression that the Supreme Court's decision, 1984 decision, a very, very famous case called Sony Betamax, had essentially created a safe harbor that would protect even entities that intended to induce and build businesses upon mass Internet piracy. The Supreme Court unanimously rejected the idea that it had created a safe harbor for the type of conduct that would be criminal under existing law, and not just kind of criminal under existing federal law. In 1996, Congress actually established that, you know, people who intentionally induce piracy en masse are actually engaged in criminal racketeering. They're running criminal racketeering enterprises. So this is really bad conduct. And what the court in the Viacom versus YouTube case has held, in effect, is that, well, even if you were engaged in the type of intentional inducement that was at issue in Grokster, as long as you responded to takedown notices, you are protected by a safe harbor. So literally, again, we're talking about civil safe harbor for conduct that is potentially criminal under existing law. There is nothing in the text of the DMCA that indicates Congress intended to protect such conduct, nor does it make a lick of sense to think that it would. And as a result of that, I do not imagine that the court's ruling could be upheld on appeal. One example that I think just makes it clear what we're talking about here. The court rules at one point in time that there's one of the limitations on the safe harbor relates to a right and ability to control. And the court says, well, you have to have item-specific knowledge of particular infringements before a right and ability to control exists. That statement is dumbfoundingly wrong. Those words, right and ability to control, were created by courts to define a standard of vicarious liability for copyright infringement that explicitly has no knowledge requirement. In other words, the court is literally holding that Congress used words that courts developed to convey the lack of any knowledge requirement to tell judges that it wanted to impose an item-specific knowledge requirement. No known principle of statutory interpretation can support that result, which is why if I were working for Congress right now, this is not a case I would be worried about in particular. We'll have to see what happens on appeal.
So Google, let's move off of Google versus YouTube. Tom predicts that it's going to be reversed on appeal. Jonathan feels like they got it right. But Tom mentioned Grokster. And let's go to this really quickly because we don't have a lot of time. Another case recently is LimeWire. And I say recently, the decision was recent, right? Let me ask Matt about LimeWire and what that represents. Then let me ask Tom and Mark about that as well.
You know, actually, I don't think it would be too helpful to drill down into the details on LimeWire, only because it's going to get, you know, it's going to take more time than we have, and it's going to be technical.
But in the context of, you know, is the DMCA and what Congress has done, you know, how is that working out with regard to enforcement of allegations of infringement?
So, actually, let me turn to what Mark was saying about...
Just stay on LimeWire for a second, if you can. Because I promised we'd get through some of these, and we only have a few minutes left. So
I think it's... Let me punt on LimeWire, just because I don't
think
I can
offer
that.
Okay, let's go to Mark and Tom on LimeWire and what that represents.
I've spent much of the past... 4 years staring at the LimeWire file sharing program, trying to understand exactly what they were doing to cause so many breaches of national, military, commercial, and personal security. I'm very familiar with the program. LimeWire is one of the worst actors on the Internet. They provide a perfect example of what happens when intent to induce mass piracy combines with willful blindness. That program did enormous damage to the security of the United States and our citizens. And it was all because of somebody was trying to build a business model based on piracy. Now, what the LimeWire case does tell you is the DMCA is not an all-purpose solution to all problems. So, for example, the problem in there with the sort of peer-to-peer programs is that if they don't implement a notice and takedown regime, and they could, but none of them did because the programs are essentially useful for no purpose other than piracy and thus never used for any purpose. 98.8% infringement rate evidence of that was accepted in the LimeWire case. So that's, the DMCA doesn't solve all problems because, of course, okay, well, how do you enforce? You can sue LimeWire under Grokster, but even once the company goes away, its program, people can continue to use its program. What do you do about that situation? Well, that is not a problem that the DMCA provides an answer to. We need to think about what to do about that. Do we really want copyright owners to try to have to enforce their rights by suing consumers who've been induced to engage in this sort of mass piracy for the benefits of the likes of LimeWire? There's got to be a better solution, and that's why we do need to think about things like graduated response, coming up with solutions to some of the problems that we didn't anticipate everything in 1998.
Tom, if anyone else wants to jump in on LimeWire, any other takers on
LimeWire?
Well,
yeah, I just want to mention two things with LimeWire. One is that the court did find it liable for intentional inducement, and second, that it's not a DMCA case. I mean, it's a straight-out copyright secondary liability case, and it lost, as it should have.
This is why I kind of think LimeWire was held liable. The company is functionally no longer a relevant player. The software application is still maybe used by some individuals, but the process worked. They were held responsible, and to some degree, if you're going to if you're going to go after these guys for developing, my concern about focusing too much on LimeWire is that at some level of abstraction, it's a general purpose tool. Right now, certainly the way that they looked, that LimeWire talked about internally, if you sort of went through their records and discovery and so on, it was pretty clear that they knew what they were doing. But at a broader degree of abstraction, it's just a file transfer application, and so is Microsoft Windows.
So you're saying that there's a difference between what their intent and what their actions were.
Exactly, and that's largely what our inducement doctrine that's come out of Grokster is probably best focused on. But that's a pretty narrow set of circumstances.
Okay, Tom mentioned in his last statement, he mentioned graduated response. And then in your opening statement, you mentioned the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. So if we can just go really quickly to that and maybe pick up from some of those threads that you guys just mentioned. Graduated response is cooperation. Mark talked a lot about cooperation between ISPs and rights holders and, giving notice to an ISP that there's some kind of infringing material or infringement going on by a user. And the idea is that, the user would get a notice once that, stop this, and then maybe get another notice, and really we mean it this time. And then the third time, there'd be some kind of consequence for not failing to abide by those notifications in a graduated way. There's been some discussion. We had a panel recently on copyright strikes, talking about the things that are going on in Europe that sometimes are called three strikes, where after a certain point, theoretically, a user's internet service would be terminated. Can we just talk really quickly, and I really mean quickly, about the ACTA agreement and what graduated response is and how that, reflects, and if maybe Matt, it looks like you.
Sure.
Want to
jump in. I can. So ACTA is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, although it's sort of misleading because it's not really all that much about counterfeiting, and it's not technically a trade agreement. But other than that, the name works. And it's a sort of a plurilateral agreement between that's being negotiated between the U.S. and a number of other parties, primarily the North countries and Europe, Japan. And some of our trade agreement partners. One of the issues that has been floated, but it now looks like in no small part because of opposition in Europe, was this idea of graduated response or three strikes where the penalties were – it would be mandated by governments that ISPs sort of put increasing penalties on users when allegations or findings of infringement, right? It's a little fuzzy as to whether we're talking about allegations or findings of infringement are made. And so at some point you get kicked off the internet, right? The so-called internet death penalty. And, you know, three isn't a magic number, and I know some of my members voluntarily have these kinds of policies, and some of them are pretty, what I find rather draconian. They'll kick users off after the first time. And, I went to them and I said, don't you think that's a little harsh? And they said, well, we want to have a bright line. Now, as I said, that's a general policy that's being discussed in a lot of parts of Europe. Whether it's actually in act or not, it's looking like that's not going to happen just because there is a lot of hostility to this. And it's no small part because, you catch dolphins in big nets. And, this happened to both presidential candidates with respect to YouTube, where they were in the last election, they had videos taken down because people were claiming that they had infringing content. Now, and I think most copyright lawyers would agree, and most courts would find that the content at issue was being used fairly and therefore not infringing. But when you have sort of automated, very rapidly moving processes like this, sometimes there's collateral damage. But so those are, I think, the two issues.
Okay.
One clarification. I mean, ACT is being negotiated as executive agreement by the United States Trade Representative. The defining quality of an executive agreement is it cannot require any change in existing U.S. law. So I have never assumed that any sort of graduated response obligation would be part of the ACTA treaty.
Yeah, no, I have to say, I have to be careful here, mainly because I used to be a cleared advisor. So I want to be very clear. I think Tom has gotten it right, that at the heart of this is a very simple goal, that there needs to be more concrete ways that the U.S. government can work in a cooperative manner with our trading partners to fight illegal things on the internet and elsewhere. And as Tom said, the heart of ACTA is based on our current legal system. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. There are dynamics in Europe. I can't comment on what's going on in Europe. But in the context of the U.S., I think that any... based on what I know, the implementation of ACTA would be entirely consistent with our U.S. legal framework.
So I'm also limited in what I can say about ACTA, but I want to clarify for the audience that when the online copyright issues come up in the context of an ACTA discussion, we're really just talking about one chapter in a larger agreement, and it's perhaps the most contentious chapter. But there are other portions of the ACTA agreement that do more deliberately focus on questions of counterfeiting, counterfeit drugs, and counterfeit devices, and the goal of stepping up enforcement borders so that when we make high quality goods and somebody knocks them off before they find their way into the marketplace, they're seized, you know, using legitimate legal processes, but nonetheless, you know, governments around the world step up their ability to protect other types of intellectual property. Those aspects of ACTA aren't getting as much play in the policy debates or in the press as the discussion around the internet chapter.
I think Mark's entirely right that really much of the counterfeiting parts of ACTA are entirely uncontroversial, and that one of the only problems here has been this sort of digital copyright issue. And there's some sort of counterfeiting advocates who've written, you know, if we just focus the counterfeiting agreement on counterfeiting, we could probably get something done.
Well, let me go to question. I have a few more questions, but I'd really welcome your questions. We only have a few more minutes, and I want to get you on your way this morning. Any questions? I'm going to ask a question later about some enforcement issues like the customs agency doing domain name seizures, which is interesting to me, and whether that we'd see legislation on the Hill that's similar to that, and perhaps just kind of going quickly over what the IP enforcement coordinator, Victoria Espinel, is doing at the White House and what we think she might be saying to Congress in 120 days. Question? Sir?
This is for Thomas. Software is moving towards a totally decentralized mix. Like you said yourself, the effort of the
you have to kind of realize that file sharing is actually likely to be a period piece. If you look at the design of a file sharing program like LimeWire, although Matt is technically correct, there's nothing about it that requires you to use it for infringement. The fact that it was used for infringement 98.8% of the time tells you that actually what is in fact true, and that is from a technological perspective, this program is incredibly inefficient. There is no reason that except for a desire to circumvent copyright protections, that you would design a file transfer system that looks like LimeWire. It is a technological abomination. And as a result of that, I think what we're going to be able to see is that, you know, attempts to basically use these decentralized technologies to design around copyright law is going to become increasingly obvious. It'll be very much more obvious what they are. I also think at some point in time, as we continue to see these inducement cases show up, again, inducement rulings mean you're talking about conduct, you're talking about civil punishment for conduct that is also almost certainly criminal under existing law. At some point in time, I think the Department of Justice is going to step in and people are going to realize they're dealing with something more than a cat and mouse game with rights holders. It is possible to come up with even more decentralized versions of these programs, and they do exist. They have existed for some time. They tend to be extremely slow. They tend to be extraordinarily dangerous. The most decentralized of these programs really cause you to lose control over your computer. I work with these programs all the time. There are some of them I won't touch because you cannot use the program at all. You can't have it on your computer without, in effect, agreeing to distribute anything anybody else wants to distribute, including child porn. That's strict liability criminal offense. So I won't go near them. So if you look at, I think this problem, once we basically reassert rule of law, and that's that copyrights are things you respect. They're not something to be designed around. I hope some of those problems will actually recede. And then we'll deal with some of the others that are also challenging. I mean, the most challenging in the long run, I expect, is, you know, what do we do with the international bad actors? I think Mark is right about that. That will ultimately prove to be our biggest challenge.
But I think also a big part of the solution is you focus on the consumer and you sort of choke this off on the demand side, which is you figure out what it is that the consumer wants, you supply the consumer with what the consumer wants, and then the demand on the consumer for this kind of file sharing goes away. I mean, you've heard about this, but here we are, we're all drinking bottled water. You know, the Senate could have given us, you know, pitchers of water, which would have been just as good. You guys would have saved some money, but I guess the sponsors are paying for this bottled water. I mean, it's kind of a total waste. It's not even green. You know, it's causing landfills and so it's harming landfills.
It has fluoride in it.
Well, yeah.
Right.
but apparently, notwithstanding all that, the tap water is still on the whole safer than any of this bottled stuff. So my point is that I think, with respect to file sharing, that a big part of the solution is going to be on our market-based solutions, figuring out how do you satisfy consumer demand, and that's the ultimate long-term solution internationally as well as domestically.
If I could just add, I think it's twice in one day, Jonathan, that we're in agreement. I think I'm stunned here.
Historic.
The day is done. You should.
But I think there's a more important, from a policymaker point of view, perspective, in addition to what Tom and Jonathan said, which is I think that policymakers have an obligation, and I give the FTC and DOJ and others credit for this, is that, you know, if you are using these systems, you are exposing yourself, your system, your business, potentially your family, to incredible risks of security, phishing attacks, and everything else. The correlation between malware and spyware and these peer-to-peer systems is enormous. And I think that at a level of policymaker education is that the market needs to respond. I mean, I think Mark Recca laid out, you know, where the global marketplace is going. We clearly have the global bad actors. We have the technical issues that are being talked about here. But I think that there's a fundamental role here for policymakers to educate and to say, you're taking a lot in your hands when you start using these systems, and you can't control them. And you're basically risking your financial information, subjecting yourself to phishing attacks and others, because that's the reality of these systems, no doubt about it.
Clearly, Tom and Mark do not like these file sharing programs at all. There's nothing redeeming about them in that view. So let me. If there's one more question, I'll be happy to field it. Otherwise, I'm going to wrap up all the other questions I have into one final question. Any last questions? Okay, I promised folks I'd get to Victoria Espinel's office in the White House. She's the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator. And I also said I would try to get to a unique enforcement approach, which has been done by the Customs Agency, where they've seized domain names of alleged infringers domain name sites that they felt were infringing. And I thought that was really interesting, and we said we'd try to talk about it. So and then in the context of Congress, Victoria Espinel's office is in about 120 days, probably now more like 95 days or something, is due to report to Congress on additional changes in existing law that would aid in intellectual property enforcement. Could we see on the Hill maybe a recommendation from her office or a bill be dropped that would kind of aid the Customs Agency and the Department of Justice to kind of seize domain names at other sites with a little more authority and do it a little more expeditiously? Is that something we might see up on the Hill anytime soon?
Well, let me just go first. I think that the it certainly seems like the ICE was very creative in its approach in seizing the domain names. But I think that that does point out a sort of a bigger issue that does feed into this.
ICE is the
immigration and custom enforcement. They're the folks who did this seizure, and that leads to the point about the review, and that is, I think law enforcement has so many tools at its disposal. The real question is which tools to use. The problem with law enforcement is rarely that there aren't enough tools, but it's that there aren't enough resources, because you need to have agents, you need to have prosecutors. It costs money. But Congress doesn't want to spend more money, especially in this budget environment, on more enforcement or and it's constrained from spending more money. So it's a lot cheaper, and this, frankly, has been exactly what's been going on for the past 15 years. Rather than spend money on prosecutors and spend money on hiring agents to go after these activities, it's just cheaper to pass laws. Laws don't cost anything. And so that's what we've seen. And so if you can look in any, for example, in copyright enforcement, since the beginning of the last century, you've seen a steady increase in the criminal penalties for copyright infringement. You haven't seen any increased criminal enforcement. You've just seen a steady increase in penalties. Why? Because it's cheap to increase penalties, right? Congress just passes a bill and says, okay, now we're going to, we're going to add another 5 years. We're going to add another 10 years. We're going to convert a misdemeanor to a felony and so forth. It doesn't cost anything. And that's the problem, that if Congress wants to get serious, rather than passing new laws, all the laws that are needed are there. All the enforcement, all the legal tools are necessary. What they need is the manpower.
Tom, Mark, at the end.
I think there is some truth. I think actually there has.
Are
been.
You agreeing?
No. I agree that there's a point at which passing laws doesn't do any good. You do need enforcement feet on the ground, and I think that's something that people certainly realize. I think with the work that after reading Victoria Espinel's report, I think that her legislative suggestions are likely to be concentrated fairly heavily on the counterfeiting side, and there. I do think there is a need to think about to basically do a pretty comprehensive review of our sort of any counterfeiting enforcement structure in light of the changing nature of counterfeiting and the role that the internet will now play in its depressingly bright future.
And there, I mean, I think that's an area where there is a need to basically systematically go through the existing laws, try to make sure that they're really all up to date. I'm not sure that has been done in a comprehensive way recently, and it looks like that's one of the things that she's going to be focusing on.
And politically, let me just jump in. I think that if any legislative proposals were to focus on counterfeiting and real counterfeiting, then the tech sector would be 100% behind that and would be, you know, really completely on the side of the entertainment industry, because they too are victims there. The problem always is in this debate, people talk about counterfeiting, but the legislation applies to counterfeiting and it applies to copyright infringement. It goes way beyond that, and it gets into a lot of the burden shifting that Matt alluded to.
I've really abused our time. I've gone way over, and I really apologize. But I really want to thank Mark Baraka for coming and presenting this morning, and the panelists for a great discussion. I'm sorry I have to wrap it up, but I'll be podcasting this later. I want to thank the panelists. Thank you so much.
Thank you.